Welcome to the last lecture of Mini Science 2011. My name is Martin Grant, and I am, still the Dean of Science at McGill University. That's not even funny. I don't even know why I keep on saying it, but I can't stop myself. But I am pleased I was able to use my dean powers to ensure, as I promised, that today would be rain-free. It's actually a beautiful day, and that's totally random and nothing to do with me. The theme of our series this year has been Better Living Through Chemistry. And last week we heard from Ariel Fenster. He explained the power and functionality of nuclear energy and his emphasis that despite many controversies, the future of this form of energy remains optimistic in many ways, but there are many challenges we have to face going forward. Some of the questions that were not answered at the end of the last lecture have been posted on the website. And this being the last mini-science, we have our last, regrettably, our last quiz for our trained mini-scientists in the crowd. It's actually quite a question. Oh, man. Okay. And here it is. Had the Fukushima plant used a CANDU reactor, how would the outcome have been different? Who's brave in the crowd? Yes. Would have stopped automatically. A good try, but I'm a tough grader being the dean. Yeah. Yes. The tsunami certainly did it in, yes. Yeah. Yeah, there's a different kind of, it's a heavy water cooled reactor, and it has tritium involved with it rather than hydrogen. I think it wouldn't have made a whole lot of difference. The main difference is that there's weapons-grade plutonium that's involved in the CANDU reactors, and that can cause a whole lot of very dirty stuff afterwards if there's really some radioactive leakage. In some ways it's safer, but the consequences are, I'm not even reading the answer here, but the consequences might be more damaging. Okay, today is a different format for mini-science, and I regret to inform you that I will sit down and just enjoy the performance, and that will be it for me after this. Okay, we'll ask you to fill out, however, the final evaluation form, but what I'd like to do now while I have an opportunity and I have everyone's attention is thank people who've done this and set this up for us for this week and all the hard work that's been done. All I do is I show up with my wife and we enjoy it and I act silly for a little while and that's it. But real work has been done by other people. First, I'd like to thank Kathy Flanders, who started the whole mini-series at McGill, starting with Mini-Med and Mini-Law. Mini-Science started 5 years ago or something like that. Our benefactor for the mini-science series is Lauren Trottier, who's helped McGill in so many ways over the years. Joe Schwartz, the Office of Science and Society, has been instrumental in lining up all the speakers for the symposium for the mini-science series, which is now coupled to the Lauren Trottier symposium, which will be held in the fall. And the people on the ground helping out. Today there are Catherine Peterson, Lydia Martone, Ann Kozowski. There was Kelly Cornford, Susan, Heather, Josie, Martine Domer. A lot of good people. Coming here after work hours and working for free. It's great. Today we have, the polka of physics. Oh, no, wait a second. Hold on. No, it's not even funny. See, I tried. No, it's actually the existential drama of mathematics is tonight. No, tonight is the magic of chemistry. It's a unique performance event that combines chemical demonstrations, slide projections, music. Well, we heard so-called music a few seconds ago. And good old-fashioned stage magic to bring science to life in exciting, entertaining, and informative fashion. The show will be performed by McGill's triumvirate alpha chemists, Joe Schwartz, Ariel Schwartz, who you've met before, and David Harp, who will be up very soon. They offer something for everyone. To the uninitiated, it is a glimpse in the wonders of chemistry. To the expert, it is a novel approach to the presentation of an ancient and basic science. And for many science participants, it's the most appropriate finale for a heck of a year. This show has been given over 500 times and has never been stale dated. There is no need to introduce the speakers, so I'm not going to talk about them anymore, and there will be plenty of time to interact and talk to them after the explosions end. So get ready for the magic of chemistry. Adjust your face masks. I hope they've been distributed. And tighten your seat belts. Away we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, from downtown Montreal, not the site of the hockey game, neither Schwartz nor Fenster can even skate, but they want to watch the game, and let's have a warm welcome for Ariel Fenster and Joe Schwartz. Thank you. Thanks very much. Well, I'm sure you don't really know what to expect. Some of you have come here wanting to see some magic, right? Well, you may see some of that. You can't do any magic without a magic wand. But many others, of course, have come wanting to see some chemistry. Well, let's do some chemistry. Let's do some chemistry. That's wonderful chemistry, you know. People don't think about that. Imagine what life was like before we were able to do that. And imagine what it is like now when we can do things like that. Chemistry is a fundamental science. It is the science that changes matter from one form to another. From one form to another. So what we're really seeing here is not only magic, not only chemistry, we're seeing the magic of chemistry. And we're seeing it in all colors, because indeed it is a very colorful subject. Come with me back for a moment to 1975. That's when we first put this show together. That's a few years ago. And what is nice about it is that nothing has changed. Back then, I used to pull rabbits out of hats because that's what magicians do, right? You can't really have a magic show without a rabbit coming out of a hat. But to tell you the truth, our focus here really isn't pulling rabbits out of hats. It's pulling molecules out of flasks. Because that is what chemists do. Molecules, of course, are way too small to be seen, except in a representation. So, I can pull a molecule out of this flask. Here we go. That's a very, very long molecule, in a figurative way. But you want to see what it's really like to be able to pull molecules out of flasks?
Well, here we have two solutions, and I really would like you to remember the names of these solutions. One is called A, and the other one is called C. So let's add a bit of each one of these. And let's see what we can get out. Well, actually, what we made here, something very simple, is just slime. Actually, if you add a green dye, it's even more disgusting.
Well, to a lot of people, when we pull these molecules out of flasks, it looks very mysterious, right? In fact, it can even look confusing. Chemistry can be a mysterious business. Some look at it as like witchcraft, mixing things together to see what will happen. Well, we'd like to show you our version of chemical witchcraft. See if you agree.
Well, here we have our magic solution. I want to ask you to remember the name of it. And we're going to add a few more drops of another magic solution. And what I'd like you to do is concentrate. Think chemistry. Oh, I feel it. Vibes coming all over this glass. Very powerful. Well, that's nothing. Now that I put the color in, I have to remove it. Let's put it back in. Okay, now, for the last trick. I'm going to try to remove the color, but take it from under. I'm picking my color, throwing it into the air, and catching it right here.
Hopefully, as we continue here tonight, you'll see some more eye-popping demonstrations like that. And I think you'll agree with me that it kind of looks magical, doesn't it? But there's a difference between doing magic and doing chemistry. In magic, I mean, we may very well use liquids, that's true, but we ask you to suspend your belief and to suspend your scientific thoughts about the natural world and use your imagination. Because magicians do things that cannot be done, right? At least the audience doesn't know the explanation. Whereas in the world of chemistry, of course, we revel in giving the explanation. You saw what appeared to be a magical reaction. It actually is pretty straightforward. The yellow color that you saw is iodine. We have a chemical reaction there that produces iodine. We also have some starch. When iodine reacts with starch, it gives you a dark blue complex. Some of the kids may have done this in school, where you take a potato, cut it in half, and put a little bit of iodine on it, and it will turn dark. So the iodine-starch mixture gives you the blue color, but a subsequent reaction destroys the iodine, the color disappears. More iodine forms, and the color comes back. So what we now have done by providing the explanation is take out the magic and replace it with chemistry. Well, that being said, with all the wonders that we can do with our chemicals, we do have a problem. We have a problem with imagery. The image of the chemist. What's the image? Unfortunately, we are burdened with the mad scientist idea. Children grow up watching this on Saturday morning TV. If not that, then the chemist is the nerd who doesn't go to parties, doesn't enjoy life, just plays around with chemicals locked in a laboratory. Then there are those who think that chemists are a completely different breed from everyone else. And then there are also those who think that chemistry really is the work of the devil. That chemicals are bad things. And in fact, you go into a bookstore today, what do you see? You walk down the science aisle, you see books about dangerous ingredients, toxic chemicals, etc. People have associated the word chemistry or chemical with toxin, with poison. They're scared of these things. It causes a great deal of alarm. That's one of the problems we face today, is the lack of understanding of what chemicals really are. With kids, we have somewhat of a different problem. You bring up the word chemistry, they think it's boring. Well, it's anything but. It's anything but. And especially this year, it being the International Year of Chemistry, I think it behooves us to go out and explain that if you just look into chemistry, you study it, you find that it's exciting, you find that it satisfies your curiosity, it gives you great satisfaction in life. Not only does it give you great satisfaction in life, it also allows you to make appropriate decisions. We make decisions from morning to night in the world of science, don't we? And those decisions are chemical decisions. We come to many a forked road in life and make decisions based on chemicals. You wake up in the morning, you decide whether or not you're going to toast your bread or not. It's a chemical decision. Are you going to put margarine on there or butter? That's a scientific decision, chemical decision. Are you going to drink a regular drink or going to drink an aspartame sweetened drink? You're going to have pizza or tofu for lunch. Those are scientific decisions. Even the kind of cookware that you use, that's a scientific decision, right? Are you going to cook in stainless steel and Teflon or in aluminum? People worry because they've heard that aluminum causes Alzheimer's disease. I've been cooking in aluminum pots all my life and I don't remember any problems. So we make these kind of decisions all the time, based upon chemicals. But you know what is the really fascinating aspect of this? Is that we can't see them. We make models of them. We think of atoms joined together to make molecules. But we can't see them. We do chemical reactions without really seeing the atoms that are involved. Oh yeah, we can get down to the molecular level schematically with our models, represented in this case by these balls, different atoms that are joined together. Some are joined together by long bonds, some are joined together by short bonds. But what we try to do in a chemical reaction is move the atoms around. So you take some of the short bonds, create them into long bonds, etc. You understand how this works, right? And then we try to do things that have never been done before. We try to mix those atoms and see, you know, just how all of this works, you know, what the mechanism of a reaction is. And truth be told, that it is often difficult to figure out exactly how that works. How we can take those long bonds and go back to the original situation that we started with. See where we have the short bonds or the long bonds, etc. And how all of this works, I mean, that's the real mystery of chemistry. And I don't know, we've been trying to figure this out since 1975, but still haven't caught up with it. But the fact is that by knowing how atoms react, even though we can't see them, we can do all kinds of things. How do we know? How do we know all of this? We know it because we study chemistry in books. Now, you might think that these are dull things, but they're not.
Actually, chemistry is pretty exciting. You have all sorts of books that explain chemistry. I know some of them are pretty old, black and white, not too many pictures. But the key thing is really to get into it. And once you get into it, it's a very hard topic indeed. Thank you.
But one of the fascinating things about atoms really is how small they are. They, in fact, are so small that most of matter is actually composed of empty space. I know that that's hard to believe, so I think we need a demo. I would like to have a volunteer for this. The young lady right there, come on down. I have a rather strange-looking device here. Hello. What's your name?
Maya.
Maya, this is the audience. Audience, this is Maya. And this is a rather strange thing. You can bang it. Piece of wood. Yes? Okay. Hard piece of wood with a hole in it. You can actually put your hand through that hole. Is that correct? Okay. And we have this other strange little device here that holds this piece of wood. Right? Now, the nice thing is I can actually pull up this piece of wood like that. And you're going to put your hand right through that hole. And I'm going to ask you to hold this apple. Right. So you keep your eye on the apple. You know that that's her hand. Right? Now, if it is true, what I told you, that matter is made up of empty space, then I should be able to push this blade right down through her hand, because it will go in between the atoms. right? If what I tell you is true. Okay, are we ready? 1, 2, 3. Look at that. Right through. And you know what is the really nice thing about this? You get to keep that apple. Hang on. I'll give you something else as well. Do you read Chinese? No? No? Then I better give you one of my English books. Here you go. Maya, the audience. Audience, Maya. Thank you. Obvious, we are empty space. Some of us more than others. All right, now with that in mind, you have a bit of an idea of what chemistry really is all about. Let's get down to some everyday stuff and how we use this science. You wake up in the morning and you look down over your polyester sheets. You don't have to iron them. They're easy to wash, easy to clean, easy to keep clean. They're great. Then you plunk your feet down on your nylon carpeting, stain-free, coated by various chemicals that will repel the dirt. You scamper over your nylon carpeting and sit down in your bathtub to enjoy some more chemistry. You're going to wash yourself with soap, but if there's some calcium or magnesium in the water, we run into a problem, because soap can react with those minerals and give you the bathtub ring. When you have calcium or magnesium present in the water, we call it hard water. You ever heard of hard water? Hard water.
Well, depending on where you live in Canada, the water can be extremely hard, like here in Montreal, or it can be soft, like in Vancouver. And what I'd like to do is show you what happens when water from Vancouver, it was flown in especially for us, just arrived 30 minutes ago, when that water flown in from Vancouver arrives in Montreal. Would you call that hard water? Well, once again, here there is an explanation. What I had in one glass was not water, it was alcohol. And at the bottom of the other glass had a small amount of saturated calcium acetate. And it has the ability of gelling, if you want, the ethanol. And what I've made right here, just to show you how simple it is what is called sterno. You know, camping stove, fondue set, and the like. If it's a liquid, like ethanol, then you can spill it, it's dangerous. If it is solid, it is much safer. And you can light it up, and it will burn. And gives a great deal of heat.
Well, soap gives us some problems, of course, because of this bathtub ring. But chemistry has a solution. That solution is the detergent. The difference between soaps and detergents is that detergents don't react with the minerals in hard water. Soaps, of course, do. Detergents have been a miraculous breakthrough, originating roughly in the 1940s.
Well, actually, I've got some detergent here. Splash, do you know that name? It hasn't arrived in Montreal. Everybody uses it in France already. Well, actually, this is a very good detergent, Splash. Remember the name. And what is really quite something about this detergent is actually the box can also be used as a washing machine. Yes, as a washing machine. And what I've done to show you how effective it is, I brought some laundry. Okay. Look at this. Oh, that blue, very difficult to get rid of. And look at this, all these different colors. And what we're going to do is that we're going to put it into the washing machine. Let's put this one. And definitely I cannot go home with this. So let's put it into the washing machine. Let's close the lid. And let's check the ingredient. DHA, DHT, PhD, some more useful than others. In any case, the wash cycle. Look how quick it is, the wash cycle. Let's open the lid. Look at this. That was a blue one. All the stains are gone. That's a multicolor one. And this is the one with the lipstick. You're not impressed? Joe, I don't know. Usually when I do this, people jump up and down and applaud. I know what you think. It's in the box. No, nothing there. You want me to open both sides? Yes? Turn it. Not convinced? Okay, I know what you want me to
do. Well, talking about laundry, one of the worst items that you ever have to deal with, of course, are diapers, right? Who wants to wash diapers? And that's why so many people welcome the disposable ones. Kids love them too. They don't get the diaper rash, etc. And these are virtually miraculous because they absorb all the wee-wee. How do they do that?
Well, let's imagine that this is a representation of a disposable diaper. And this is a baby byproduct. Let's see what happens. Let's put it into the diaper. You understand why the liquid is not coming down? It's because of the centrifugal force. You see how quickly I'm turning it? It doesn't even have time to move. Well, actually, being chemistry, I can explain to you what it is. Inside the diaper, and strategically placed, there's a material known as sodium polyacrylate, nicknamed super slurper. And let's repeat what was in my glass there. Now we're going to do the same thing, but you can see what is inside. You see how it gels the liquid. And this is the reason why disposable diapers are much more comfortable. And by the way, this is the reason why today there are diapers for girls and diapers for boys. Because you need very little of that material. And they have to be strategically placed. Because from an anatomical point of view, girls and boys are different. I hope you know that. Okay? So you can have that. But actually, the same material can be used to make artificial snow. Let's say you want to shoot a movie, a winter movie in July. Well, unless you live in Montreal, you're not going to get snow in July. But you can get sodium polyacrylate. And let's add again some water to it. Very sticky snow.
Talk talking about the centrifugal force that keeps it in there, because some of you have studied physics, right? So you know that. Physicists can do that, but we're chemists. We're better than physicists. Let's see if physicists do that. All right, well, diapers, artificial snow, where else can we use chemistry in our daily life? How about in our armpits? Because antiperspirants, of course, are chemicals, and they require a lot of research. And there's a lot of research that goes on in the armpits of the nation to find out exactly what sweat is all about and which are the most appropriate chemicals. But so many other consumer products that we use on a daily basis. We use hair permanence, for example. That's pretty neat, because what we need to do there is break down the sulfur-sulfur bonds between protein molecules that constitute hair, reshape the hair, and then use an oxidizing agent to reform those sulfur-sulfur bonds, and the hair is held in its novel shape. So every day we make use of chemicals. But I think the most interesting class of chemicals that we use every day, the ones that we are most fond of, are the ones we eat. Because let's face it, food is an important player in life's game, isn't it? Just think about the amount of time we spend that revolves around food. We think about what we're going to eat. We plan the next meal. Then we eat it. We talk while we're eating it about what we're eating. After, we talk about what we should have eaten. We talk about what we could have eaten, and by that time it's time to think about what we will eat the next meal, right? So food is very, very important. Wine is also very, very important. Beverages are important. Indeed, if you had a waiter that could provide you with virtually any beverage that you wanted, that would be a pretty, pretty welcome commodity, right?
Absolutely. Well, let me tell you the story of this waiter. He had really trouble keeping up with all the requests that he had from the customer. Somebody wanted white wine, red wine, beer, and so on. Well, what he decided to do, he decided to take a chemistry course. And this changed things completely. Because if somebody would ask him for some water, well, water, that's pretty simple. And for you, sir, what would you like? Wine. Sort of very pale wine. Maybe not wine today. My stomach is not too feeling too well. Maybe I should have some milk instead. Oh, but maybe beer. Oh, a good beer with lots of foam. That's going to be really very good.
Well, we kind of joke around about our food these days, but we're also quite critical of what we eat, aren't we? We want to know the vitamin content, what preservatives are used, how safe our food supply is. We worry that some additives can have consequences, like causing hyperactivity in children. A lot of people worry about the chemicals that are put into our food, think that it is nasty chemists who are putting some collage of unknown substances, unknown cancer-causing agents unleashed upon an unsuspecting public. Unfortunately, that's the image that is out there. Food is a very complex mixture of chemicals, to be sure. And people are worried about synthetic chemicals. They want to go back to eating the so-called natural way. Right? Like a good old apple. Apple a day keeps the doctor away, we're told, right? At least if you throw it at him or her, it does. But there are many, many interesting compounds in those apples. What? Let's take a bite. What are you really tasting when you bite into that apple? You're tasting a whole collage of chemicals. Those are not additives. Those are the natural building blocks of that apple. That's what it's made up of. There's some interesting compounds in there. For example, acetone. Last time you encountered that one was probably on the label of a nail polish remover right under where it says, do not drink. Because acetone can be poisonous. You look a little bit further down the list here, you'll see formaldehyde. That's embalming fluid, right? Most people worry about consuming that, especially in conjunction with acetone, which is toxic. But it's okay in this case because the acetone may kill you, but it's quite economical because you'll be pre-embalmed. Right? Of course, it's absolute nonsense to say this, because as Paracelsus told us 500 years ago, the famed philosopher, alchemist, only the dose makes the poison. The amount of acetone in there, the amount of formaldehyde is absolutely trivial. It doesn't do us any harm at all. In fact, the beneficial chemicals in those apples greatly outweigh all of these detrimental ones. But people worry, and similarly they worry about chemicals that leach out of plastics, even though those are in inconsequential amounts, the same way as what we're talking about here. But apples, to be sure, are interesting. And you realize that there are all kinds of flavors in the apples. Well, you saw a partial list. Those are some of the flavors that are in the apples. But there's more. There's a lot of sugar in the apple, obviously. A fair bit of sugar. That's roughly the equivalent in one apple. But the apple is mostly water. Now, all of this is theory. But I bet what you'd really like to see is how an apple is really made, right? Well, we can do that for you.
Well, in order to do that, we need a volunteer. And I think this young man here, just right here, has volunteered. Yeah, the man with the glasses. Please. Well, Grant, we're going to make you do some chemistry. Please step to the limelight. We'll see if you really picked up all these 500 chemicals that were present in there, or at least some of them. Anyways, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to make some apples in there, okay? But of course, we have to put all the chemicals in there, okay? So you remember there was some sugar, absolutely. That's, yeah, put the sugar in. Okay, then remember there was lots of water.
Lots of water.
Well, we sort of economical here. Budget cuts. Okay, and then 500 different chemicals. And they're all in there. Maybe you don't notice them because remember they're present in very, very small amounts. So I'd like you to throw them all there. I think you have to shake it. So do I, that's okay. Okay, so anyways, I think they're all gone. Okay, let's see if you did a good job. Excellent! Look at it!
Well, apples are the ultimate natural food, I guess, for most people. And we should be eating more of them. But much too often these days, we resort to processed foods. Like chicken noodle soup, for example. That has a huge collage of chemicals in it. Some of them, of course, you expect. The noodles, obviously. But look at the next ingredient. That's salt. Most people don't realize just how much salt there is in their chicken soup.
Well, I'm going to try to demonstrate this with this salt meter. Here we are. Okay, so essentially what we have here, we have got two electrodes, okay? And plug it in, put it in water, nothing happens. Of course, water does not conduct electricity. What we're going to do now is that we're going to put some salt into the water. Let's see if it makes a difference. Sodium chloride, sodium ion and chloride ion. Now what I've got chicken soup. Chicken noodle soup, Lipton chicken noodle soup. And what I'm going to try to do is put my electrode with a light bulb into the chicken soup. You ready? I would suggest that you put your safety and your sunglasses on. This gives you an idea how much salt is present in the prepared food. And this is a point to be made. You know, we worry about all these strange sounding chemicals and MSG and the like. But sodium chloride salt is probably a much more serious problem than the other one.
Well, so far we've given you a little bit of a basic chemistry lesson about what chemicals are and the role they play in our life. But it's also interesting to go back historically to see how we've arrived at this age where we have pretty good knowledge about what chemicals can and cannot do. So let's go back to a time when there was nothing. As someone up there said, let there be light, and there was light, chemical light, of course. And then another pretty good trick was performed, and man was created. Well, we're not really sure how that happened. Even today, we're just starting to look into the mysteries of life. We're looking into things like test tube babies. We are beginning to understand the mysteries of cloning. But, of course, early man knew nothing about this. He found himself on the earth, he looked around, and he was amazed. There were all kinds of fascinating natural chemical processes going on all around him. He looked on one side, and there were geysers erupting. Really neat stuff. You've probably never seen a geyser react, right? Well, this is your lucky day. We're going to take you to the southern U.S., California. Now let's see if we can see a geyser erupt.
I can get the light to work. Well, enough light. Yeah, plug. Plug. Thank you. That's why we bring him along. You know. Here we are. It's slowly happening also.
You know how geyser works? Of course, there's lots of water deep within the ground, and there's a lot of geothermal energy. The water gets heated and changes into steam. The steam builds up pressure until there's enough pressure to send it through crevices in the rock and in the soil to the surface and erupt to the geyser. So right now what we have is a chemical reaction that is producing steam. And as the steam builds up, you begin to see it erupting. It's an exothermic reaction. It produces a great deal of heat. And there's our geyser. And this reaction is a fascinating one. And to me, it actually has relevance. Because one of the reasons that I got interested in chemistry way back, back to the 1960s, was because of a TV show, A Dream of Jeannie. I used to love that show. Barbara Eden was pretty nice. Kind of in love with her. And I watched the show. And do you remember how the show began? Her master, played by Larry Hagman, finds a bottle on the beach, he picks up the bottle, and out comes the genie. And I remember thinking, how did they do that? How do you do that? How do you make steam come out of a bottle? And when I was in graduate school, that's when I learned the chemical reaction. And it turns out that this is exactly the one that they used in the show. The bottle was gimmicked. One container in it had hydrogen peroxide, the other one had manganese dioxide. When he picked up the bottle, turned it, the two chemicals mixed, and out came the genie from the bottle. And as luck would have it, a couple of years ago, I had a chance to perform on behalf of Discovery Channel at a trade show in Vancouver, a TV trade show, and this is where the networks trot out their programming and try to sell it to each other. So I was there doing chemical demos, something like this, and lo and behold, I look over the next booth, the Arts and Entertainment Network, and they had just purchased the rights to the old I Dream of Jeannie TV show. Who should be there promoting it was Barbara Eden. 30 years later, legs as nice as ever. So I left my chemicals behind to explore the right chemistry, and I chatted her up and asked her if she remembered how she got out of the bottle. She said she didn't even remember how she got into it, because of course she wasn't around when they did the special effect. And I showed her the reaction, what you just saw, and her eyes popped open. She had never considered any kind of a chemical connection. She had never studied any kind of chemistry. But of course, she had been seeing over the years, reruns of her show for 30 years, seeing this chemical reaction, never wondering about it. All of a sudden, she looked at her own show in a different light. So that's how she came out of the bottle. But how do you get a genie back into the bottle? That's where you need a genie catcher. And this is something that most people do not have. Oh, they can make genies come out of the bottle like that. But to catch a genie, that's a different process altogether. So, we're going to try to do that here. We're going to try to catch the genie that came out of that flask there you just saw. And I'm going to try to get her back in here. This is an absolute novelty. This has not been done before. So let's see whether or not we've been able to capture the genie. Easy come, easy go. It's more difficult to catch Barbara. There were many other things that early man and early woman saw as they looked around. There were geysers erupting, but there were also all kinds of plants growing all around. For example, wild grapes. Someone had the idea, gee, let's squeeze them with a grape press. That one is 3,000 years old. We still squeeze grapes today. Of course, we have a more modern technique to do it now. And, of course, we do it to music. But the process is essentially the same. You get the grape juice, you allow it to ferment, and it changes into wine. Well, this is one of the most interesting chemicals that we have. And who better to talk about wine than a real Frenchman from France?
Thank you. I think that was a bit short. I don't know if I... Well, again, I'd like to tell you a story of a friend of mine. He loved white wine, but he had read that, you may have heard of the French paradox. What's good for the heart is the red wine. So he had all this white wine, and he didn't know what to do. That wasn't going to help him in terms of heart problem. But knowing a bit of chemistry, he took his white wine and changed it into red wine. So remember, he took all his white wine, added it together, and got red wine. But then another problem developed. The problem with red wine is that it's rich in histamine. Histamine can cause headaches. So my poor friend had all the time migraines. So, well, I better go back to the white wine. But now he had all this bunch of this batch of red wine. How was he going to do it? Well, again, chemistry. He took his red wine, used the right chemicals, and converted it back into red wine. So you remember how it got started? It got started with white wine being converted into red wine. And now all the red wine went back into white wine.
I'll tell you another interesting story. We don't usually tell this, but you're a special audience, so I'll tell you this one. Most people don't know this connection. This is absolutely true. I'm serious. Houdini, who really was the greatest magician who ever lived, or at least he said he was, only ever performed one chemical magic trick. But that was always a part of his show. And that was the trick that he did. And he did this during Prohibition. And he told the story of someone making moonshine and making the red wine and the white wine. So in a completely different context, but that's the only chemical trick he ever performed. In any case, alcohol, of course, is certainly an interesting chemical. And people indulge in it because it's delight-giving effects. Of course, the delight can give way to tragedy when you indulge too much. And the more alcohol there is in a beverage, of course, the more risky it is. Wine can be anywhere from 5 to 11%, but then you have the other beverages, you know, the hard alcohol ones, and those can be up to 40%. And it's better to cut down on those as much as you possibly can. So anyway, back to ancient times when they were going to grapes to press them, and they figured out how to actually do this properly. Those were the earliest adventures in genetic modification, right? You cross certain varieties of grapes to try to get improved ones. But that was not the only kind of plant life that they were interested in. There were all kinds of fascinating chemicals to be found in plants. What you're looking at here is the madder plant. And the root of that plant gives a dark red color, a naturally occurring dye. And this was one of the most interesting of all of the ancient dyes. Well, back in those days, all dyes came obviously from natural sources. For example, the coat of many colors that Joseph wore. You remember that biblical story. Well, how on earth were they able to make a coat of so many different colors back then? It all had to do with natural dyes.
Well, that's what we have here. We have different natural dyes, and they're all stored in this flask. They just need to be taken out. So, for instance, one color, another one. Well, not too much difference, but still enough. But you see, what we have done is that we have created from this one flask all these different colors. And what we'd like to do now, we started with a clear solution, and we would like to see what happens when all these colors are mixed up again. We go back to the clear solution.
Then already they were investigating colors and how you could mix them and where they were extracted from. But colors could lead to problems. Remember the story of Joseph and where his multicolored coat got him. It got him into Egypt, and his descendants, of course, were enslaved and forced to build the pyramids. Until one day Moses came along and he stuck his staff into the Nile River. And the river turned blood red. Well, how did they do that? Maybe it was divine intervention, or maybe Moses had a chemical trick up his sleeve.
A natural chemical trick. In fact, there is a little insect that is known as the cochineal insect that gives a very, very bright color, very bright red color, something that could have happened to the Nile. Well, in fact, today, the cochineal insect is used to give natural food dye because people want natural. And I've really got some of these dried up insects here. Put it in my hand. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to crush them.
They are dead. Animal rights activists.
I just want to give you an idea how intense that natural color is. From the red cochineal insect. Recoil in horror, but actually whenever you eat your strawberry ice cream or the like, that's what you got. This dead insect crushed up. But it's natural.
Well, Well, finally, the Pharaoh had had enough of Moses' miracles, and he said, take your people and go. And they left the land of Egypt to wander through the desert. They wandered through the Sinai desert for 40 long years with very little food, very little water, until one day they came upon a pond in the Sinai desert, the pond of Marah. It is still there today. They were happy to have found water. They began to drink the water of the pond, and they found that it was bitter. We today would say alkaline, because minerals leach out from the soil into the water. What were they to do? So Moses turned to his research director and said, God, what are we to do? And as most research directors are wont to do, he gave good advice. He said, take those pieces of wood which lie beside the water, throw them into the water, and then you will be able to drink it. It's all recorded in that great chemistry book called the Bible. Well, what's the explanation here? Well, when minerals leach out from the soil into the water becomes alkaline. They're basic minerals. When wood lies out in the sun for a long time, the cellulose gets oxidized, and we get gluconic acid and glucuronic acid. So Moses took the acidic wood, threw it into the basic water, performed history's first recorded titration, and made the water safe to drink. So they were fiddling around with titrations, but eventually, of course, this led to a problem. They did manage to get to the land of Israel. No, Moses turned the wrong way, but they got there. And that, of course, led to the powder keg that the Middle East is today. Well, where does that powder keg expression come from? Back then, the ancient Chinese were fiddling around with gunpowder. They found that if you mix sulfur and charcoal together with saltpeter, you got an interesting concoction. Today, of course, we call it rifle powder or black powder because it makes a lot of smoke. It's been now replaced by smokeless gunpowder, but we'd like to show you the difference.
Well, smokeless powder is nitrocellulose. Black powder is, as it was mentioned, is a mixture, grounded up mixture of potassium nitrate, saltpeter, sulfur, and charcoal. So what I will light up first is the smokeless powder, the nitrocellulose, and at the end, I put a little bit of black powder, just a little bit to give you an idea as of the difference. That's the black powder. So you can imagine on battlefields what it was like before nitrocellulose was introduced. After a while, you didn't know if you were firing on your friends or on your enemies. That was pretty annoying. So as a result, the nitrocellulose became very, very quickly widely used.
Gunpowder was not invented on purpose. It's not as if they were looking to find something like this. It came out of explorations of alchemy, which were directed towards finding the secret of life. And the ancient Chinese were interested in that. They were looking for magic potions that would make people live forever. The Europeans picked up this thread as well, and alchemy became a very, very popular pursuit. It focused in mostly on gold. The ancient Chinese were interested in that, but the alchemists of the Middle Ages in Europe as well focused on it. Why? Because gold seemed to be eternal. It lasted forever. It didn't tarnish. They thought that if they could find the secret of what made gold gold, they would also find the secret to what they would call aurum potabile, or drinkable gold. Well, they looked and looked. They combined all kinds of things. They combined lead with mercury. Didn't work. The alchemists are now long dead. Lead is still lead. No one has been able to make gold. But out of those kind of attempts came interesting discoveries, such as the discovery of gunpowder. But there were many, many other discoveries waiting to be made. Once we get to the 17th century, we turned a corner towards modern science. Joseph Priestley, with his discovery of oxygen, although he didn't really recognize it as an element, but nevertheless, by heating mercury oxide, he was able to identify a substance that allowed combustion to take place much, much more readily. And thus really began the modern era of chemistry. He was followed by Humphrey Davy very quickly in England. Davy was a marvelous chemist, inventing what was called the Davy safety lamp that you see beside him on the table there, that saved the lives of thousands of miners, because mine explosions were very, very, very common. Methane in mines is highly explosive. With this simple device, just a wire screen around the candle, with the wire screen dissipating the heat, he was able to save all of those lives. But he did something else that was very important. He introduced a public lecture on science. People flocked to these things. One of his favorite demonstrations was that of nitrous oxide, or laughing gas. Volunteers from the audience would be asked to come up, inhale some of the laughing gas. Here's Davy with his impish grin, having just made some, and the gentleman has inhaled it, and there it is making a triumphant exit from the rear. People, of course, from all walks of life came to witness these fantastic demonstrations. This was before TV, before radio. This was the form of entertainment. But perhaps Humphrey Davy's greatest discovery was Michael Faraday. Faraday, arguably the greatest scientist who ever lived, if you judge it by the diverse areas that he was interested in. He discovered elements, he discovered novel compounds, he really was the father of electricity, and he was an absolutely fantastic public lecturer. Every Friday night, people would flock to the Royal Institute in London to hear Faraday lecture. In fact, Albemarle Street in London was the first street ever to be made into a one-way street, because there was so much carriage traffic on those Friday nights that they had to do something about it. Faraday was an absolutely fascinating man. But there was a youngster who had a huge impact at that time as well. William Henry Perkin, when he was 16 years old, begged to be allowed to help out in what had been called the Royal Institute of Chemistry, set up by Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, who was a great friend of science and public scientific education. He had set up this institute for older students. But young Perkin had become enamored of chemistry, and he wanted in. And he said that he would do anything. He'd wash dishes, he'd help out in every way. He was basically a pest, but he was allowed in anyway. And one day in 1856, during the Easter holidays, when the college was going to be shut down for 2 weeks, Perkin went to Hoffman, the director of the institute, and he said, "Can I do something at home so that I'm not bored for 2 weeks?" And probably more to get him off his back than anything else, Hoffman said, "Why don't you go and try to make some quinine?" Quinine was much sought after in those days. It was the only drug that could alleviate the problem of malaria, as you heard in one of the previous lectures. It's a very, very difficult compound to synthesize. They had no chance of doing it. But it kind of made sense in the context of the times to take a coal tar derivative called aniline, react it with an oxidizing agent, hoping to get quinine. This is what he did in the Easter holidays. And one day, he threw all of his chemicals out because all he got was gums and tars and dirt. And all of a sudden, the sink turned into a brilliant new color. No one had ever seen this color before. Most people would have just looked and said, "Gee, you know, how do I clean this?" But he recognized he had made a discovery. That discovery was the first ever synthetic dye called mauve. It had a huge impact. Of course, it could be used to color fabrics. Everyone wanted clothes made with this wonderful new dye. Queen Victoria loved it. The decade after its discovery is still known today as the mauve decade. It was of such importance. In fact, if you stop on a street corner, a policeman would come up to you and tell you to move on. Perkin became the elder statesman of chemistry because he had founded not only the dye industry, but in that process, the modern pharmaceutical industry as well. Because if you could make dyes from coal tar, who knew what else you could make? So they began to try to make drugs. And that was really the beginning of the big pharma industry. Well, let's go back to that era when Perkin was fiddling around with his chemicals, trying to make all kinds of colors, and made the different hues, the reds, and of course the mauve, which became so popular. And luckily for him, his father had money. So he was able to borrow some to build a factory. The factory, of course, had large cauldrons where the chemicals would be combined, but at first the factory was really nothing more than the empty shell of a building. And in there, he would combine his chemicals. And out of that mixture of chemicals would come colors that were totally new, colors that no one had ever seen before. Beautifully colored fabrics, mauves and reds, blues and greens and yellows. Of course, what happens when you color so much fabric with so little dye, you run out of the dye. So what do? You go back into the lab.
And you can make more synthetic dye. And this is a very interesting chemical reaction because this reaction works with music.
Little tacky paper.
No. We need something a bit more energetic, something to break these chemical bonds. But the only problem is that you have to keep shaking all the time, if not the dye disappears.
Perkin in 1906 came to the United States to give public lectures and also to be honored with the first ever Perkin Medal, awarded in 1906, and it has been awarded every year since then to the top industrial chemist in the U.S. It is one of the most sought-after awards. And the ceremony takes place just as it did in 1906 at Delmonico's restaurant in New York. And only the high and mighty of the scientific community are invited to the annual Perkin dinner. And if you're lucky enough to get an invitation, it comes in an envelope together with a little bow tie that is colored with Perkin's original mold. Ladies get a shawl. And it literally is colored with a batch from his original batch. Because when he came in 1906, he gave a sample to Columbia University. And that sample has been maintained there, and every year they take a little bit of it, dye some fabric, and use that to make the bow ties. So it's a fascinating story. But the dye disappears.
So we have to go again. Oh, shake. I hope I don't have to do that all night.
Well, there were other discoveries made at that time. Over on this side of the pond, Charles Goodyear, who I'm sure many of you know because he was named after that blimp that you see at football games, found that there was a way to make rubber into a much more useful material. Rubber, of course, is an exudate of the rubber tree. This white latex, though, is pretty useless, the way that it comes out. But what he found was that if you took sulfur and you heated that latex with sulfur, it would turn into a wonderful, useful, stretchy material.
Rubber. Well, actually, I want to show you how vulcanization improved, the addition of sulfur to rubber, improved its stretchability. Here I've got a balloon, which, of course, you have to blow. And what I have here is a very sharp needle. Balloon, needle. Thank you.
Of course, it's all a trick.
Trick needle.
Now, it's essentially pretty simple to do. It's very important to have a very sharp needle, and it's very important to know where to place the needle. You place it at the end where it's not completely stretched, so that what happens is that the rubber will stretch alongside the needle and prevent the air from escaping. If you puncture on the side, it cannot stretch, then it blows up.
So vulcanized rubber is good. You can use it for all kinds of things, including national defense. Back across to Europe, Switzerland this time, Christian Friedrich Schönbein, a Swiss chemist, according to the story, used to take his work home with him. His work involved nitric acid and sulfuric acid. One day he happened to spill it on the floor, and being a wife-fearing man, he knew that he'd better clean this up before Frau Schönbein made an appearance. But he didn't know quite how to do it. So he grabbed the first thing that he could that happened to be his wife's cotton apron hanging on the wall. He took that cotton apron, put it in front of the fireplace, and the next thing he saw was that. The apron vanished in front of his eyes. For a moment, he probably contemplated doing the same thing before she came home, but then he thought better of it because he knew that he had made a discovery. He just wasn't sure what that discovery was. The world wasn't waiting for vanishing aprons. But the world was waiting for something else. It was waiting for smokeless gunpowder. The old-fashioned gunpowder, as you saw, produced a tremendous amount of smoke. Battlefields were full of smoke. Schönbein looked at his apron, and he saw that it had burned with no smoke. Being a chemist, he knew that the apron was cotton. Cotton was made of cellulose. He wondered if the cellulose had reacted with nitric and sulfuric acid to form a novel substance. So he took some cotton, reacted it on purpose with the same acids, and discovered, in fact, that he could reproduce this. You want to see it again? They always do. Whether it's kindergarten kids or PhDs, you burn something, they want to see it. All right. So the apron and the fireplace, and there it is. No smoke whatsoever. Of course, once more, the important thing is that he knew that he had made a discovery. Most people would have said, gee, where do I go to buy another apron? But he recognized, and as Louis Pasteur was to say, chance favors the prepared mind. His mind was prepared. One discovery leads to another. And Count Hilaire de Chardonnay was next in line to make a discovery. And he found that if you took this material and you squeezed it through what looks like a shower head, it came out in the form of a thread. Which I thought I might have a little piece of, because it makes for a very interesting thread. So that might be,
yes it is. Thank you.
I thought I had some. It makes for a very interesting thread. So you squeeze it through this spinneret while the thing is in solution, and as the solvent evaporates, you get a thread. And of course, you can use that to make all kinds of fabrics. And it looked very, very pretty. In fact, it was called Chardonnay silk at first. But there was a problem. It was made of nitrocellulose. And that's why workers in the factory where this was made took to calling it mother-in-law silk. Some of you will appreciate that. Others will learn later on. But there were all kinds of other interesting things going on at that time. And it's fascinating how you look back in history and everything gets interwoven. You know, we were talking about chemistry, we were talking about magic. Well, in the 1800s, those two mixed together again. Robert Houdin, the greatest magician of the 1800s, and of course, Eric Weiss, stole his name, added an I to it, and became Harry Houdini. Robert Houdin was really the first of the scientific magicians. He designed all kinds of fascinating apparatus based upon science. One of his classic illusions was the pitcher that would never empty. So he would take the pitcher and empty it to the last drop. But the fascinating thing about this pitcher was that it would never empty. People had seen it empty. Well, he would pick it up again. And spill it out to the last drop. Fascinating picture. People saw it empty. They saw him shake it, came out to the very last drop, and yet that pitcher would once again deliver more water. But there was something that Houdin was bothered by. He loved to do the magic. He loved the special effects. But he disliked when people took scientific magic and pretended that it was real. Took some of his inventions, actually, and pretended that they had paranormal powers by taking the pitcher, which was empty, and showing that once again it was full of water. And he decided that there was a need to reveal that these things were done scientifically and not by magic. Of course, he never revealed the exact details, but he started a society of skeptics to make sure that people understood that these were not done by paranormal means. But today, people still, of course, do that. They still take containers and then show that they, you know, empty and they fill with water and they pretend that they do it for real. This unfortunately happens a great deal in India with the so-called God men who pretend to be able to take empty containers. Right? And deliver water. And they can also, if they want, make the water that they poured in there vanish. Houdin developed these kind of illusions. Now, of course, they are all based upon science. And when you know that it's scientific and you present it as a form of entertainment, it's great. But when you do it to defraud people, that's a completely different story. Mendeleev, of course, had no interest in defrauding anybody. He put all of this scientific information about chemistry together with the classic course, which is the periodic table. And we're all familiar with that. This is kind of the alphabet of chemistry. And we can talk about it, but it would be far better to sing about it. So let's go to Tom Lehrer, former mathematics professor.
Entirely from the mainstream of this evening's symposium, I'd like to sing a song which is completely pointless, but is something which I picked up during my career as a scientist. This may prove useful to some of you someday, perhaps in a somewhat bizarre set of circumstances. It's simply the names of the chemical elements set to a possibly recognizable tune. Because there's going to be a short quiz next period. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and lithium and magnesium and strontium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum and plutonium and palladium and rhenium and potassium and polonium and tantalum 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 and tantalum
Of course, many since then have been discovered, so the song could be made longer today, and people have been begging him to do that. He's still alive, and he doesn't really perform much in public anymore, but he can still sing, and it would be great to have this repeated with some of the newer elements thrown in. Well, anyway, back then, after Mendeleev's discovery, chemistry was flying high. Better living through chemistry. I mean, this was an accepted slogan. Nobody raised an eyebrow. Chemicals were high profile because they were delivering the goods. They were making our life, in fact, better. 1939 saw the introduction of nylon at the New York World's Fair, developed at DuPont. This was a giant molecule. The inventor, Wallace Carruthers, a young American, first one to make this wonderful new substance. Nylon today plays a huge role in our life, and it's manufactured. It's done by the millions of pounds every year. You take small molecules and you join them together to make long ones. Of course, it's much more interesting to see this in real life rather than figuratively. So why don't we do that? Why don't we make some nylon for you?
And it's pretty simple to make nylon, but it's difficult for me to do it alone. Maybe this young man here, can you give me a hand? Yes? What we're going to try to do is that we're going to make nylon in that small beaker, two solution, and I'm going to tell you what they are. They're sodium chloride and 1,6-diaminohexane. Maybe we should call them ANC, yeah? Okay. And here I'll put sodium chloride. One 1,6-diaminohexane. And maybe you notice there, the two solutions do not mix. See? It's like oil and water. And the nylon forms at the interface of the two solutions. You see that? So what we'd like to do is to pull the nylon fiber from in between. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to pull up. Can we maybe come to the side? I'm going to pull up, and you're going to pull the beaker down. And it's very important not to touch the side. Oh, too good. Let's make sure we don't touch the side. Are you okay? Yeah! If I can go up a little bit more. Very good. Thanks a lot.
When we say nylon, of course, people immediately think of nylon stockings, but there's much more to nylon than that. One of the first applications of nylon was in toothbrushes, both the bristles and the handles. You know what the bristles were made of before nylon toothbrushes? They were made of little hairs pulled from the back of pigs. Pigs did not enjoy this. So when nylon came along, they breathed a sigh of relief. But of course, it was the nylon stocking that made this material so famous. 1941, on Nylon Day, ladies stood in line around the block overnight in front of Macy's, waiting for the store to open so they could purchase these brand new stockings made of petroleum, because that's where the raw material comes from. Some of them couldn't even wait to try them on before they got home. But that was not the most practical use of nylon. That was the parachute. Because during the Second World War, the U.S. was cut off from its silk supplies in the Orient by the Japanese. Silk was needed for parachutes. You don't win a war without parachutes. Well, all of a sudden, nylon became available. It replaced silk, so it had a tremendous impact on the war effort. But it was indeed made from petroleum, as are other plastics. The Graduate, one of the most famous movies of all time. You remembered one of those scenes where young Benjamin is graduating and his parents organize a party for him, and a friend of the family corrals him and takes him over to the corner and says, Benjamin, I have just one word to say to you. He was going to give advice for his future, whispers into his ear, plastics. Right? Because that was the coming material. This was the 60s. Everything about plastics looked great. Benjamin wasn't all that interested in getting into plastics. He was more interested in getting into Mrs. Robinson. But anyway, plastics were flying high back in those days, decidedly. All kinds of novel items were being made of plastics. There were plastic cookware. The Tupperware era began. We started to pay for things with plastics, right? We have since even developed plastic money. You have some?
Let me just check. Wow, what a surprise. A $5 bill from Australia in my wallet. How did it happen? Actually, this is made from plastic. And I'd just like to have two young men, strong men here. Two guys there, yeah? Are you brothers? Okay, what I'd like you to do is come down here. Let me check. Yeah, they're pretty strong. It should work out. Okay, guys, one stand here, the other stand here. I want you to grab this $5 bill and pull as hard as you can. Okay, you ready? Both hands. I think you have to have both hands. Again. Okay. Okay, now, actually, let's do it you alone. Try to rip it. You try. Yeah, please. Fun to see him trying, huh? Well, actually, this is made out of plastic, high-density polyethylene. And the reason why I'm showing it to you, that in the fall, in October, Canada is going to have its first plastic money. Thank you.
You guys, you need some practice, you know, for when we get the plastic money. So you ask your parents for some money now. Try to work out the technique. So plastics are great, but there are problems. There's pollution problems. And, of course, there's a problem of where we get the raw material for plastics. It comes from oil. We have a love affair with oil, don't we? And the fact is that eventually we're going to run out. We are going to run on empty. The Earth has a fixed amount of oil. I mean, we're constantly looking for new places where oil can be found, but eventually we are going to run out. So we thought maybe we'd give a try to making some synthetic oil. How about that?
Well, let's give it a try. You may have heard that oil sometimes is called black gold. Let's see what we can do. One into two, two back into one. Let's do it again. And let's see what happens there. No, not gold. What we want is black gold.
Of course, oil has to be refined before we can use it, so let's refine it. Okay, now we can make things out of it. Here's my factory. Nothing in there. Right. But luckily, we now have the oil. A few drops. Look at all the stuff we can make. Fish, for example. As long as the fish is made of plastic. And we already told you that there are a lot of problems, right, that come from not having enough oil, and that these are some of the problems. But the nice thing is that with chemistry, we can solve those problems easily. Oh, it's all got to do with molecules, of course, and those are made of plastic as well. And the medications that we use, those are made of plastic. And the cosmetic products, the shampoos, etc., are made of plastic. But you know what? No matter what I pull out of there, people are not satisfied. They say they've come to a chemistry show, gee, where's the rabbit? Would you believe people want to see a rabbit come out of there? Of course, as you know, the only kind of rabbit that you can make out of petroleum is a synthetic one. We're interested in all kinds of things, more than just making synthetic rabbits. We're interested in insects. We're interested, believe it or not, in the love life of insects. The love life of insects.
You don't want to make the oil disappear?
No, I want the love life of insects.
You want the love life of insects. Okay, well, what I'd like to mention to you is the wonders of pheromones. Pheromones are chemicals that are produced by insects, usually by the female, to attract the male. And now it has been used to control insects. For instance, what you can do is that you can have traps with pheromones in it, and the male smells a female but can't find her, or when he finds her, he finds instead the glue. So I want to show you how powerful pheromones are. This is a representation of a mosquito pheromone. And just before the show, we have released some male mosquito in the audience. And what we're going to do is that we're going to attract them to the pheromone. They're all going to come into this glass. And actually, there is something very special here, is that we have taught this male insect, we have taught them to drink from a straw. So actually, there are two ways of doing it. Either you can apply the pheromone to a trap and there is some glue. So the insect, the male, comes in expecting bliss, gets glue. The other approach is to saturate an area with the pheromone. The male insect comes, smells the female all over the place but can't find her, and eventually dies from the gush. Look at this. They are really quite something, huh? Let's see if they're going to drink everything here.
Do you know where the raw materials come from to make these pheromones? They come from the same source as for plastics. They come from oil. And that's the real problem. We have that oil refined, but eventually we're going to run out.
Well, anyway, look at this. They're really amazing.
They're gone, huh? It's all
really
gone.
Quite,
yeah.
I mean, just a few drops.
But there's another problem with oil, is that right now we get most of it from the Middle East. And we have to transport it. And we transport it in large containers. And ships. Large tankers cross the ocean, carrying all of that petroleum, sometimes filling it. But the problem is that eventually we're just going to run out. So that's why we need to conserve. We need to look for greener pastures, as it were. Well, finally, there's one other thing that we chemists are interested in, and that is pain. Our students, of course, suggest that we're interested in inflicting it. But no, we are in fact interested in solving the problem of pain. And we don't want you to go home with any painful procedure. So I want to tell you about how we go about solving the problem of pain. But I do need a volunteer for this. The young lady right there, come on up here. Hi, what's your name? Emma? Yes? Hi, I'm Joe. Emma, this is the audience. Emma, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, have you ever in your life felt pain?
Yeah.
Yes, that's good, because then you have some experience here. Now, I want you to turn around and tell me if you've ever done anything like that.
Yeah.
You've never swallowed a sword? What school do you go to? And they don't teach you sword swallowing? You hear all these things about the education system in Quebec, you know, progress. But, gee, I didn't know that you didn't know how to swallow a sword. You know what I was going to do? I was going to make you swallow a sword. At the same time, I was going to tell everybody about why you don't feel any pain when you do that. But since you've never done this, we have to do this a little bit different. I have a little device here. This device is called a neck stock. A neck stock. You have any idea why it's called a neck stock? Neck. you have one. Yes? This goes around your neck, like that. Face the audience. Now, what we have here is a sword. Now, normally I ask people to swallow it this way and talk about how you can get your mind to concentrate on it, have your brain release chemicals called endorphins so you don't feel any pain. In fact, that's why in battle, soldiers don't feel their wounds until after the battle because they're so stressed, their brain is synthesizing these chemicals. But since you've never done that, we're going to do this sideways. Okay? Usually, you tell your volunteers, don't worry. Here, it helps to worry because then you're going to be making all of these endorphins, but you don't really. But what I want you to do is tell me if you feel the sword at all. Yes? She feels it. You know why? Because she thought that I'm fooling around, that this is just a magic trick. But now you know that the sword is real. Correct? Correct? Okay. You tell me when you feel something. Okay? Here we go. 1, 2, 3. What do you feel? Nothing. Turn around so that they can see you. The sword is right through. Yes? And it was totally painless. That's the wonder of endorphins. Now, have you ever done this before? No, me neither. No. I've done this before many times. I get to this part. Taking it out is what's difficult. Your parents are here? Where are they? Yes. She goes home like this, is okay? All right, let's worry, worry, worry. We'll take it out. Look at that. Without any pain whatsoever. How does that feel? Let me give you something. I assume you don't speak Chinese either. So we'll give you an English book too. But I want to give you something else that I hope you'll remember for the rest of your life. This applause is just for you. So, we're on the verge of solving pain. But chemistry really is like a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we can use it to make bombs. On the other hand, we can use the same chemicals to create fertilizer and feed the world. The choices are really up to us. Whether it's going to be pollution or whether chemistry is going to be our savior. Once more, quickly, Tom Lehrer.
Visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste.
So we do have problems, for sure, but we also have ways of solving them. Chemicals have had some bad press, and they have gotten us into trouble. But we chemists never surrender, because the same way that chemistry gets us into trouble, it can also get us out. So we've come a long way on our chemical journey. We started way back with the first gunpowder explosions. Today, we're on the verge of traveling into deep space. We've already seen the Earth from afar. We've seen the moon, right? From the moon. We've seen an Earth rise from the moon. It's really incredible when you think about it. The other extreme, of course, is what is happening at the molecular level in the test tube, right? Well, there's news that comes about these things every day. we pick up our newspaper, and virtually every day, there's some new story. It can be a happy story about chemistry, or it can be a troublesome one.
Well, this is what I find. You know, sometimes the newspaper likes to hype up the bad news about science and chemistry rather than the positive information. And, you know, sometimes I get so angry when I look at the way chemistry and science is presented. So you know what I do? I take my newspaper and rip it apart. Because can you imagine all these trees that have been cut down just to give this negative view of science? So I cut my newspaper into little pieces because, of course, I have to dispose of it in an ecological manner. So I fold it, I cut it, fold it again, and I'm ready to dispose of it. And I hope the message we're giving you is that, yes, there are sometimes bad news, but overall, once you open your newspaper, you get more of the good news than the bad news.
So we've seen the Earth from afar. We're on the verge of creating life in a test tube. We're understanding the mysteries of DNA. The real question is, what does the future hold? Is it going to be a future full of clean water, fertile soil, a future with new sources of oil, a future without any nasty bugs, a future with all kinds of miracle drugs? Well, the answer to all of those will come from someone, somewhere, working in a laboratory, and it will all be done through the magic of chemistry. I know that people like pops and bangs and explosions, but still, you've been to a magic show, and we use the rabbit as the logo. You don't want to go home without a rabbit, right? And as I told you, since 1975, we've been at this. We've been trying to make a rabbit appear. And maybe we've been going about it the wrong way. Maybe we should be looking for that rabbit in its natural habitat, which, of course, is a top hat. Ah, what do you know? Almost. I'm getting better and better at it, you know. I've almost made the whole rabbit, not quite, but I did make the most important part, because this is here. Certainly to discuss and answer whatever questions you have, or just ask you to keep the kids away from the table. And thanks for attending the whole Minisci series.
Being such a good sport. All right. So did I.